Welcome to Potsky Wee Wee. I'm Josh Smith.
I'm Mike Graham.
Hey, Mike, how was your Thanksgiving?
It was good. It's good. Yourselves?
Not bad. Family came over. We had sort of a big thing. One of my cousins just had a baby at the beginning of September, so this was the first sort of outing for her little daughter, and everyone was kind of excited to see the kid, and that pretty much dominated Thanksgiving. I pretty much just sat and watched football with my dad and my brother and my uncle, but everyone was always about the kid. But we had a good meal. A lot of people came over. It was fun.
Yeah, I had a good meal too. I had the turkey and ham, so got the combo.
You're a two meat guy.
When the two meats are presented, I consume.
See, me and my brother had this discussion a couple days before Thanksgiving about if you have turkey and then any other meat, I feel like the other meat is sort of just forgotten about because you don't have turkey too often. It's maybe a Thanksgiving thing. Maybe you have it at Christmas. If you bring out a second meat, people will pick at it. I guess if people are big ham people or big roast beef people, they'll go after that. But the turkey seems to go the quickest, don't you find?
Oh, yeah. The turkey was delicious, but so was the ham. You don't get turkey that often, but nothing wrong with throwing a little ham in there.
Now, here's my big question for you. Are you a beef gravy or a turkey gravy guy?
I go turkey gravy. You go beef gravy?
I go beef gravy. My grandmother has been making gravy for decades, and it's just delicious. It's not that I dislike turkey gravy. I just find that beef gravy is just so damn good. And hers is homemade. She throws a bunch of like vegetable water in there, and like I'm pretty sure there's meat fat in there as well. But it's so good. Yeah, we never really do the turkey gravy. I think we had some this year, but it's just not the same.
I don't know, man. I like the turkey gravy. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
I like the beef gravy. I like all gravies, but I got to go turkey gravy on turkey. I just
makes sense, right?
Yeah, but I've never tried the beef gravy on turkey, so I can't really judge it. So I'll take your word for it that it's good.
I've never had a holiday meal where we haven't had beef gravy on the turkey. I guess it could technically be turkey gravy if you're putting turkey fat in it, but it's brown and like turkey gravy is that more yellowy beige color. But
we
go right into the beef gravy, and it's weird because most people are also like, you put beef gravy on turkey? That's nuts. Doesn't it taste like beef? And no, it just tastes like gravy, and gravy's delicious. If I could drink it and not worry about clogging my arteries, I probably would.
Yeah, it is pretty scrumptious.
What's your vegetable of choice at Thanksgiving?
I like the potatoes. You know, you can put some gravy on the potatoes. I like some carrots. It's not really a vegetable, but I love me some dressing too. That's, you know, you gotta have the dressing.
Interesting. See, I'm a Brussels sprouts guy, and this always floors people because everyone has this negative connotation towards Brussels sprouts, but I liked them even when I was a kid. You know how you can barely get kids to eat their vegetables? Throw a plate of Brussels sprouts in front of me, like no butter, no salt, nothing like that. Just boil them, throw them in front. I would eat in a whole bushel of them. They were that delicious.
I never really got into the Brussels sprouts, I must say.
No, and that's normal. That is the normal response to people bringing up Brussels sprouts is either I'm not a fan or those are disgusting, and I'm just like, give them all to me. I will eat every single one of them. And I'm a corn guy too, so Brussels sprouts, corn, you got your stuffing, you got your mashed potatoes, and you're not a bigger dude, but I'm a pretty big dude, but you're a guy that likes his food, and Thanksgiving's one of those holidays where you can just dig in, wear some sweatpants, and just go to town.
I'm a big corn guy too, I must admit. I love the corn.
Cob or canned?
You know, if I can get cob, then that's the better way to go, but I'll eat some canned corn too.
Yeah, cob's great for the summer. In the winter, it's a little harder to get that. Thanksgiving's usually a can of corn, and I'm with you. Cob corn, the best. I could eat that all day long.
Where I grew up, they had a little like local farm, and they had the best corn on the cob ever. It was Highbury Farms, I believe. Little promotion for them, but it was just the best corn on the cob you could ever taste.
We used to just get it from the grocery store, and then my uncle found like a shack on the side of the road one time and bought this corn, and was like, it was like a nickel a cob or something stupidly inexpensive. Brought it to the house, we tried it, and it was freaking delicious. And it was ever since then, we just go to this tiny little shack. I believe it's on, if you know your Hamilton geography, a little past Centennial and Rymel Road, and just kind of like a little, it literally looks like a lemonade stand that they sell corn at, and just absolutely delicious.
Yeah, it's usually the way to go, not the grocery store for the corn on the cob, although you can get the odd good corn on the cob at the grocery store, but usually the local farm dealy is the way to go.
All right. So they got the win, man. They went into this game against Saskatchewan needing to win this game. I know we said it wasn't a must win, but it was a gotta win, and they got the win. So kudos to that. What was your standout from the game?
Well, you got to go with Matthews. I mean, first drive was the two and out, and I was like, oh boy, I was a little worried. And then the second time they got the ball, I believe it was the McCollum missed a field goal, and then Banks brought it out only to about the 5-yard line. And I was thinking, we're backed up pretty good right now. Now we need something to happen, and Matthews and the offense drove the ball a long ways into Saskatchewan's territory and really, you know, set the tone for the rest of the game and got three out of it, and then it just took off from there.
During that first drive, they had the long bomb pass that Terrell Sinkfield caught around the 15 or 10-yard line. Do you remember that play?
Yeah.
Okay. I watched that happen, and I turned to my friend who I sit with in the stands, who we bring up almost every week, or I bring up almost every week, and I said, there's the difference between last week's game against Calgary and this week's game against Saskatchewan. They made that play. A week ago, it was Giovanni Aprile who he threw that very same pass to, and it went right through his hands. And as we said last week, that changed the outcome of the game. If they would have hit that, they might have gotten some momentum, they might have gotten some confidence, and they could have maybe won that game against Calgary. This week, they do the exact same thing early in the game. They hit the pass. They end up going to kick a field goal on that drive, but I think that that was sort of the confidence boost that especially Jeff Matthews needed, and it helped propel them to this victory.
Yeah, for sure. He looked great the whole game. You know, on the third drive, he had the long toss to Underwood, and then, which I believe on the same drive, he would have had a first down if Underwood hadn't have dropped the ball. So that would have been in the, I think, a 15, 20-yard gain and would have kept the drive going. So early on, he could have put on, you know, more points on the board than they actually did. So just early on, Matthews looked great. Except for the first drive.
The drive you were talking about after the missed field goal by Saskatchewan, Matthews had a designed run. And as we all know, he's not what you would call a mobile quarterback. He stands in the pocket and he slings it. And boy, did he ever stand in the pocket and sling it. We should bring up his numbers. He was 22 of 33 for 385 yards, three touchdowns, and he had the 27 rushing yards. But on that second drive after the Banks return that got him to the five, which I believe Kent Austin just tore into Brandon Banks in the sideline as soon as he got back. But then they run this play, and it just seemed like from there on, the spark was there for the team, and they, you know, they rolled out to an early lead, got up, I believe it was 20-0 at halftime, and that was pretty much ballgame.
Yeah, I was impressed with Matthews. You know, he's not the fastest guy, but he can get up to a pretty good speed when he has to. You know, he rushed the ball a little bit in this game. He almost got away from John Chick on that one play, but yeah, if he has to get out of the pocket and scramble around a bit, he can. You know, he's not Claros back there, but he can get some yards rushing the ball if it's really necessary.
Yeah, he was really impressive, and I know we said people would downplay it because of how bad Saskatchewan was, and I did see a little bit of that online where people were like, we have to put into account that he's playing the Riders. But to me, it seems like he built on his performance in the second half of last week's game where he played a little bit better than he did in the first half. And the big thing with him this week is he did not turn the ball over. He got sacked, I believe it was four times. In the past, though, he might have fumbled once or twice. He did not. He protected the football, and that to me is how this team is going to win going down the stretch here. He does not have to, you know, be a 66% passer, doesn't have to throw for close to 400 yards, just needs to protect the football, did that against Saskatchewan, and Saskatchewan didn't protect the football, they threw two interceptions, so that was, to me, the difference in the game.
I agree, and, you know, even though there was four sacks on Matthews, I thought the O-line did a really good job at giving him a lot of time. I think if the O-line can do that the rest of the season and into the playoffs, we have a pretty good shot because Matthews has a lot of time back there to make decisions. I don't think he's going to make a lot of mistakes, and I think he'll put up some good numbers and put up some points on the board to really help this team.
I completely agree with you about the offensive line. It felt more like those sacks were coverage sacks, where Matthews had a good 3-4 seconds in the pocket, but just guys weren't getting open, and that forced sort of Matthews to make his third and fourth reads, and by the time he got there, the pass rush got there, because Saskatchewan's pass rush is pretty good. John Chick's a good player. Terrius George is a good player. They lost Alex Hall very early in the game to what looked like a really bad knee injury. I'm not sure what the diagnosis has been since, but he was hobbling. He needed the cart to get off the field, so that probably tells me it's pretty serious. But Saskatchewan got some pressure, but it was mostly, like I said, due to good coverage downfield. And if you want to talk about awesome numbers, Terrell Sinkfield, man, he once again had a phenomenal game. He's been your guy all year. Sing his praises.
Four catches for 163 yards and a touchdown. He had that, you know, it was just a simple slant route, I believe, and he broke one tackle, and then it was clear sailing from there. I think it was 80-yard touchdown, so he's just been doing it all year, and he keeps producing, so good on him, and you just can't take, receivers keep coming back off the injury list, but you can't take Sinkfield off the field, because he's just been doing it game after game after game, and just keeps producing.
He's the team's leading receiver. He's on pace to have over 1,000 yards receiving. He's been a big-time playmaker since he's got back on the field after his benching in the summer. And Sinkfield and Underwood were two of the guys that were in and out of the roster there, and I think we saw the difference between the two. Underwood had a good game himself, 5 catches for 108 yards and touchdown, but he had 2 big-time drops. You brought up the one earlier that was right in his hands. He was open between 3 or 4 defenders. Matthews hit him perfectly. He found the perfect spot. He just didn't haul it in. He had another drop near the red zone later in the game. Those are the reasons why Underwood, whom I'm a fan of, I like Tyquan Underwood. I think he's a good receiver, but it's the inconsistency that he is showing as to why he's the guy that usually is the game day scratch. He played this game because Terrence Tolliver missed it due to injury, but if Tolliver's healthy, Underwood's probably scratched and doesn't see the field. And I think we now sort of completely understand why that is.
Yeah, for sure. I like Underwood too, but you know, you got to get Tolliver in there when he's healthy, because he's been a big producer this year for the Ticats. So yeah, I think this receiving corps is going to look pretty good once Tolliver comes back and Fantus comes back. I mean, it looks good right now, but wow, we're going to have a lot of talent when those two players get back.
Speaking of coming back, what about Eric Norwood's first game back? Man, he was all over the field on Friday.
Okay, he had 1 sack, and he was making a lot of tackles out there, just flying around, you know. Didn't seem to have any rust at all. So when we have Norwood and Hickman on the end of those defensive lines, it's a pretty good combo to have.
Yeah, and the team just seems to be getting healthy. We're going to get into it. You teased it a little bit by talking about Andy Fantus, and we're going to get into it a little later about some of the guys that look to be returning. But this is the perfect time to get these players back. Jeff Matthews needs all the help he can get. He played a great game, but again, he's still a rookie quarterback. That was still just a second start. The more talent that this team has, the better they're going to be. I'm very excited about this upcoming slate of games, because I think this win over the Riders is that confidence boost that they needed.
Yeah, for sure. It's how many games left? Is it 4 now? Or
it's 4.
The Saskatchewan game, you know, yeah, it's Saskatchewan, but they needed that. They really needed that. They needed to see Matthews have a good game, get some confidence in him, and then 4 games down the stretch, we're going to really see what he has and what the team has with him behind center. So it's going to be a very, very, very interesting stretch of games here in the last 4 regular season games.
What did you think of the play of Michael Ford? We talked about him a bit last week. We both kind of were impressed with how he played against the Stampeders. What do you think about his game against the Rough Riders?
I thought it was another good game. You know, I just like how he runs. He's between the tackles guy. He runs with power. You know, he didn't have huge numbers. I think he was similar to his game last week. He was like, you know, 10 for 54 yards rushing, I believe. So 5.4 rushing average, which is, you know, it's not terrible. It's not spectacular. But when Gable comes back, he'll be the guy. But I really like how Ford plays football.
Yeah, I am a lot more confident if Gable is to sustain an injury again that the Ticats still have a back who they can run the football with. And it makes me wonder what they didn't see in him early in the season, because he was with the team in training camp and he was on the practice roster to start the year before getting cut. I believe it was sometime in late July, and then he ended up signing in the NFL with, I think it was the Atlanta Falcons, and was with them in training camp. He has played, like you said, not spectacularly, but impressively. He is a between the tackles runner. You know, 5.4 yards per carry is nothing to sneeze at. That means you give him the ball twice, he's going to pick up the first down, and yeah, that's exactly what you need. If you're over 5 yards a carry, if you're approaching 5.5 to 6, that's what you need out of a running back. And there was one play in particular in that game where he literally put his head down, rammed through the middle of the defense, and picked up a first down. And that was stuff you weren't seeing when Nick Grigsby was back there and when Ray Hawley was back there. Ford doesn't dance around. Now, Gable is a playmaker, so he's going to do a lot more than Ford does, but I like having Ford as an insurance policy. It gives me a lot more confidence that going into these cold weather games, should CJ Gable once again succumb to injury, knock on wood, hopefully it doesn't happen, that Ford can be the guy to tote the rock for this team.
He's not Gable, but he's a good fill-in when he's not there. And, you know, like, Gable's had his injury troubles, so you never know what's going to happen when he comes back. So if Ford has to come back in, I'm fine with that. He is familiar with the offense. He's a good blocker in the backfield. So he brings what the team needs from running back in this offense. I as well have full confidence in Ford if he has to fill in again.
There's one more player that I would like to talk about, and that's Brandon Stewart. Do you remember back in the winter when I believe it was Arash Madani sent out a tweet saying that the Ticats were cutting Brandon Stewart? I think we talked about it maybe on the very first episode.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Well, I know he hasn't really been a starter and he wasn't spectacular last year, but I was really impressed with his game. He's done well when forced into action. He had a wonderful special teams tackle on a punt, corralling Nick Dembski of the Riders. He had an interception in this game. He's not a guy that's getting a lot of publicity, but he seems to have accepted his role as a backup and a spot starter and a special teams guy really well. You know, he's not making a ton of plays, but he's making plays when they matter. That interception of, I believe he was the one that picked off Kevin Glenn, that was one hell of a jump that he made on that play.
He's been impressing me too, you know, when he's getting in there. You know, he got a lot of heat last year, especially in the playoff game when SJ Green really, you know, burned him for, I believe it was 3 touchdowns. But yeah, that interception was great. He really jumped up there high, got the ball. And then I do some game notes while I'm watching the game, and I wrote down that Stewart had a great pursuit tackle on Dressler in the fourth. So he's been doing a good job when he's getting in there. So I'm glad to see him get a little redemption from last year, because a lot of people were calling for his head last season.
Yeah, and I thought that was premature. And I'm sure if we go back to the episode where we talked about it, and I'm fairly certain it was our very first show, because I'm pretty certain that the idea of Stewart not being on the team came out around Christmas time or a little bit after the new year. So when we started the show back in January, I'm pretty sure we had a discussion about it. And we were both more common level-headed and said, let him get out there and try to compete and all that stuff. I like to think of myself as more of a rational person and not an emotional person. Sometimes we let emotions get the best of us. But look, this team has built a squad that can compete. They know what they're doing with their players. They see their weaknesses. Stewart is not meant to be out there guarding the league's top receivers. Like you said, he was burned by SJ Green. Now, SJ Green has burned some of the best defensive backs to ever play in this league during his career with the Alouettes. So it's not exactly like Brandon Stewart's alone and being burnt for 3 touchdowns by SJ Green. But yeah, Stewart's not shouldn't be out there guarding the team's best receiver. He has a role in this team, and I think they finally found what it is. And now he's a solid contributor. And I, for one, am happy for him. I like Brandon Stewart, so I'm glad he's found his niche role on this team.
Yeah, me too. Another block punt for the Ticats, which, you know, is if they're going to do that every second game or so, that's great for the team, because, you know, whatever they can do to get momentum going their way or get deep in the other team's, you know, near their end zone. So a block punt by Ganey right near the goal line, which was huge. I believe they're only up 3-0 at the time, and then right after that Matthews throws a touchdown pass to Tasker, and off they went.
Yeah, that was not the first blocked punt that they had gone for. Earlier in the game they went for 1-2, and I believe it was Mike Daly ended up hitting the Saskatchewan punter, and that extended the Riders drive. I believe that was actually the Riders first drive of the game. They ended up going down the field and missing the field goal, but they clearly saw something in film study that said the Riders were susceptible to blocked punts. But that said, like you brought up, they've been blocking punts all the time. I believe that's now 5 blocked punts on the year, so they're getting one every third game. That is incredible.
That's just a huge lift to the team. And then they also tried the fake field goal, which fell a little short, but it was an interesting call, because they were up by like 3 touchdowns at the time, and they really wanted to put the nail in the coffin, I guess. But you know, I guess they're maybe testing out some things before the playoffs and see how they work. It didn't work out that time, but it was a really good tackle by the Saskatchewan player, and you made a really good play, so it could have worked out if that guy wasn't right there to make the tackle.
It was an interesting time to run that. Yeah, maybe they did want to sort of put the foot on the throat and just end the game there. I'm not entirely happy with them running it at that point against this team. Maybe save that wrinkle, because like you said, it was a great tackle by the Saskatchewan defender. Otherwise, that would have worked. Now, that's not to say they can't run it again, but maybe now that puts the fear of a fake and other teams. Here's the thing. There has to be a reason why they ran the play, other than just let's run up the score, because that doesn't seem like a thing that they do. It was an interesting call. It didn't work. It didn't really hurt them in the long run, obviously. They still won the game. To me, it was just a curious time to sort of try something like that.
Yeah, I was scratching my head a bit too after they did it. But that just got me thinking about the onside punts that they've done in the past. And you think that they're going to do that in the playoffs?
I think it all depends on wind conditions. The onside punts seem to be something they do when the wind is bad. They didn't try one against Calgary, which was surprising to me. I remember going down to the game chit-chatting about what they might do to sort of, you know, it was Matthews' first start, and maybe they could steal a possession or maybe try to find a way to score on special teams or defense. And the onside punt was something I thought that they would try, and they never even attempted it once. It's one of those things that they do very well. They've done it, I think, at least twice, maybe 3 times in the last season and a half. Obviously, the big one was the Brandon Stewart touchdown touchdown against Toronto back in August. Maybe that's sort of the arrow they're keeping in the quiver for a big-time meaningful game, because it has worked, and we know Jeff Reinbold is not afraid to try things, so it's definitely there. Maybe, again, they're holding it back so that teams kind of forget that they do it.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. And, you know, it's not like a huge risk throwing that play in, you know, and they're not going to, you know, it's not like a fake field goal where they could turn over the ball or anything. They're just, you know, it's I think they're just, they tried it at Labor Day. It worked perfectly, and they're just holding off maybe until the playoffs begin to hope that the other teams, you know, forget about that play and they can surprise them again and take another possession for the team in the playoffs.
Now, apparently, Jock Climie made this ridiculous comment during the game about how the Ticats should trade essentially whatever they have to get Kevin Glenn. He apparently said this at halftime of the game, after Jeff Matthews was something like 17 of 19 or 15 of 17 for 191 yards and two touchdowns. And he's on this show saying they should trade a starter and a first-round pick and a late-round pick to bring Kevin Glenn back. When is this going to stop being a topic of conversation amongst anybody? I guess when the trade deadline passes on Wednesday, because this is Matthews threw for 385 yards and three touchdowns, and Kevin Glenn was yanked at halftime. So why is this even still a point of discussion?
He just is going with experience. You know, he said that with every team. He said, bring back Ricky Ray over Trevor Harris, you know, bring back Lutley over Jennings, bring back or trade for Glenn in Hamilton. So I kind of get the experience thing. You know, experience is a good thing to have, but it didn't help Glenn, you know, in many playoff games. Games. He had experience. He lost them in a couple, in one Grey Cup game at least. Was it just one game that he's played in the Grey Cup?
Yeah, with Calgary.
Yeah, so that it didn't help him there. You know, he had a good team in Calgary, and you know, it's not all his fault. That's not what I'm saying, but he doesn't perform great in the playoffs and in Grey Cup games that we've seen so far. So I just don't see going for Glenn. It's just go with Matthews. We're gonna ride Matthews until we're out of the playoffs or until we win a Grey Cup. So I just don't see the logic. You know, he was saying that, you know, he's playing the Rough Riders, so it doesn't matter. It doesn't count. The Rough Riders are a bad team, yes, but they're a professional football team. He's just playing who's put in front of him. He can't help who's playing, so he had a great game against Saskatchewan, and maybe he can build off that and have great games going through the rest of the season.
We're all guilty of downplaying terrible opponents, and yeah, the one caveat about this game is he was playing a bad Saskatchewan team. However, sometimes you have to play a bad team in order to build confidence to do well against the good teams. They're going to play Montreal next week. Montreal looks, defensively, they're pretty good, but that team looks completely lost, and we'll get into them in a little bit. But like you said, you can't help who's put in front of you. If he performed poorly, then people would have been all over him. He played well. Like that's the beginning, the middle, and the end of it. And this idea of trading for Kevin Glenn, I don't ever want to talk about this again. I know I brought it up, but I'm sorry. I'm sick of it. And you would think an ex-player would kind of understand how airlifting in another guy this late in the season, especially a quarterback who I presume, if he's saying trade a starter, trade a first round pick, trade a late round pick, trade whatever you have to get him, is saying that he's going to come in and start. I would think an ex-player would know that it's not that easy. Football's not like basketball or baseball or hockey, where you can bring a guy in and suit him up and the fundamentals of the game are the same. You play hockey, you're shooting the puck at the net. And I don't mean to be downplaying how difficult it is to play these sports, but you bring a guy in at the trade deadline and baseball, and it's catch the ball, throw the ball, and hit the ball. It's not exactly the same as coming into a football team and trying to learn a brand new playbook with brand new terminology. It's really difficult. This is why you very rarely see mid-season trades in football, and when you do see them, more often than not, they don't really lead to all that much. It's the same when teams sign players mid-season, especially CFL teams, when NFL cuts happen and they bring in these guys that have been cut by NFL teams, and you don't really see them light it up. And every now and then you do, sure, but Justin Hickman last year, for example, had one sack in the entire time he was with Hamilton, and now he's got six or seven this year. It takes time for these guys to get back into, or just to get into, the scheme that they're going to run and understanding their responsibilities and all that stuff. You're going to bring in a quarterback with 4 weeks left in the season, and expect him to start and be productive? I just think that's completely idiotic.
Yeah, I mean, look what happened when Saskatchewan brought in Kerry Joseph last year. I mean, it was a disaster. You know, I think Glenn's a better quarterback than Joseph, but just like what you said, I believe, you know, I don't have the Ticats playbook in my arms, but I've heard that it's pretty complex, and, you know, there's a lot of improvised organization on the with the receivers and stuff like that. So, you know, Glenn's not going to come in here and just poof, pick it up, and he's going to be throwing for 500 yards each game and five touchdowns. So, you know, it took Claros a bit of time to get used to this offense and get really rolling. You know, he had a good year last year, but you could see this year that he really grasped it and he really took off and really had a good really took a hold of the playbook. And Glenn's not gonna have that opportunity with 5 weeks left, and Matthews has been there all year. He hasn't been taking first team reps, but he's been studying the playbook, and you know, I think he's our best shot, not Glenn.
So let that be the last we ever talk about Kevin Glenn coming back to Hamilton. I guess, you know, like I said, the trade deadline is Wednesday. So if he's not moved by then, he's not getting moved. We don't have to listen about it. I don't want to talk about this in the off season. From now on, we have a moratorium on Kevin Glenn to Hamilton talk unless Kevin Glenn's actually in Hamilton. Okay. That's it. I'm not going to bring it up again.
I agree. I like those terms.
All right. Bold predictions. We were wrong. You picked Luke Tasker with 100 plus on the touchdown. He only had 50, but he did score the touchdown, so you're half right. Yeah. Not bad. And you got halfway there in the yardage. You know, Matthews threw for almost 400 yards, but it was Terrell Sinkfield and Tyquan Underwood who were the guys. Although on that touchdown pass, Tasker couldn't have been more wide open.
Yeah, I saw it coming from a mile away. I'm like, get him the ball, because you could see him open for a couple seconds before he threw the ball. So, yeah, he was pretty much uncovered that play.
And I had Michael Ford going for 100 plus on the touchdown, and you brought up his stats earlier. He had 10 carries, 54 yards. So I was off on that one. We got a very little bit of Ticat news to talk about this week, and it's news that I am very thankful for. We just had Thanksgiving pass, and if there's something I'm thankful for, it's injured players returning. Yesterday at practice, they practiced on Thanksgiving Monday. They have a long week because they don't play until Sunday in Montreal, so I'm not sure if this was an extra day of practice. I presume it was. But at practice, suiting up, practicing, were Andy Fantuz, CJ Gable, Rico Murray, and Ryan Bomben. Those are four big names that could potentially play against the Alouettes, and even if they don't, those are four big names that are on the mend and will probably be starting for this team before the end of the season. That's huge.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about Gable so many times, what he brings to the offense. It's huge. Fantuz coming back is huge. Bombing on the offensive line is huge. Who was it? Rico Murray, you said? That's a huge addition to the defense, too. So all these guys coming back near the end of the season is a great thing for the Ticats. You know, Claros is out, but if we can get all these other guys back, you know, get the most talented players on the field, I think we have a shot, because Fantuz is gonna be a big part, you know, possession receiver. He can make those catches on second and short, get those first downs. Gable's going to bring a lot to the team with his running and his blocking and his catching out of the backfield. If these guys can stay healthy the rest of the season into the playoffs, it's going to be, you know, gigantic for this team.
As good as Tim O'Neill has played on the offensive line since Bomben got hurt, I have to think that he's not, at this point in his career, he's not meant to be a starter. He's better as that sixth offensive lineman. And that's not, I'm not knocking Tim O'Neill, he's been great, but to get Ryan Bomben back, I wonder what Michael Ford could have done if Bomben was on the offensive line. But obviously, the two big names are Gable and Fantuz. Fantuz coming back will create a fifth receiving option. No offense to the guys that have filled in. Matt Coates filled in admirably. Giovanni Aprile has been less than stellar, but he's still out there trying to contribute to the team. But what Fantuz brings is another weapon that teams have to game plan against. You can't just throw any old DB out there to guard the Canadian receiver the Ticats are going to start if it's Andy Fantuz. And having Fantuz back just makes everyone better. It's going to make Matthews better. It's going to open up holes for Tasker and Sinkfield and Grant. It's the team just gets better when Fantuz is out there.
He's just a reliable receiver that can make those big catches when you need them on second down. So he's, you know, he's a threat in the end zone because he's a tall guy. He has those big hands. He can jump up and get the ball. So he just brings a lot to the team, and I'm stoked that he's going to be back for this playoff run.
He was the team's leading receiver before he got hurt, and unfortunately for most of his career, the caveat whenever you talk about Andy Fantuz is ... before he got hurt. But healthy during the stretch run, healthy for hopefully what is a Grey Cup run. If we had to lose him in the middle of the season to make sure he's here for the end of the season, I guess I'll take it. I guess I'll have to take it because that's what happened, but that's not a terrible hand to be dealt. And CJ Gable, as great as Michael Ford has been playing, we've mentioned this a bazillion times, Gable is just a difference maker at tailback. He can catch out of the backfield. His pass blocking is superb. This is another weapon that Matthew's going to have at his disposal. It makes me a lot more bullish that this team can make some noise late in the season and into the playoffs, with even with a rookie at quarterback.
It's happened before, you know. Rookie quarterbacks have won championships, so it's not out of the realm of possibility. You know, I believe Ricky Ray was a rookie when he won a championship, was he not?
I'm not sure if he won it as a rookie. They got to back-to-back Grey Cups with Edmonton, but I think they lost the first one and won the second one. I could be wrong. I'm sure someone out there will correct me if I'm wrong, or correct you if you're wrong, whatever. I know he got to back-to-back Grey Cups his first 2 years. I guess not sure if he won the first one and lost the second one, or lost the first one. I can't remember what it was. But yeah, he was definitely a young quarterback when he won it. And another example is Casey Printers. I believe he was, if not a rookie, it was maybe only his, you know, he'd been with BC for maybe a half a year or maybe even a full year. And he came in and he was MOP and lit it up for BC, even though they eventually did not start him in the Grey Cup. And he only played because Dave Dickinson, who was a Hall of Famer, got hurt. BC didn't miss a stride. So you're right. Rookie quarterbacks and backup quarterbacks have won Grey Cups before. So it's not entirely out of the realm of possibilities that the Ticats could win it all.
Yeah. And if this, you know, if Matthews leads the Ticats to a Grey Cup or a Grey Cup appearance, at least, you know, he's going to be a hot commodity in the offseason. So we've seen it over and over again. You know, starting quarterbacks get injured, the backup comes in, and then it's an audition for his future as a quarterback in this league. You know, other teams want to pick up winners. So if he can put some wins together, you know, get to a Grey Cup, win a Grey Cup, he's going to be on the list for starting quarterbacks in this league.
Yeah, no doubt. I don't think he is really pushing for that personally. I think if the Ticats win it all with Jeff Matthews at quarterback, I don't think he has a hard time coming back here and being the backup to Zach Collaros next year. And maybe this also would give, if Matthews plays well, even if this team gets to the Grey Cup and loses, as heartbreaking as it would be for this team to get to a third straight Grey Cup and not get the victory, if they get there with a rookie quarterback, that just gives me more confidence going into next year that they can allow Collaros, if he needs a little extra time, to mend from his surgery and his injury, and Matthews can hold down the fort. Playing Matthews now, as much as the Collaros injury sucks, what we're able to see is whether or not this team can win without him. The knock on this team was that if they lost Collaros, they were done. And they look far from done.
Even though the Collaros injury sucks, they're just too good of a team to fold after their leader goes down, and they just got to pick it up and keep going.
So let's get into the rest of the games this week. We had a rare Tuesday matchup. Obviously, last week's show we recorded on Monday and then put out on Wednesday, and this game happened in between. So we are a little bit late on it, and I know people are sick of hearing about it, but we haven't had a chance to discuss it yet. We have to talk about it. The Chad Owens catch with 25 seconds left to win that game. I've said numerous times that I do not like Chad Owens. You don't dislike him. You had an interesting and very nice meeting with the man, so you are, I don't know if you're a fan of the guy, but you don't hate him like I do. But even with my dislike for him, I can't help but that was one hell of a catch.
Almost made me jump out of my chair, you know, like I wasn't cheering for the Argos or anything like that, but it just looked like the ball was so overthrown and he just reached out and grabbed it. It was a great catch, and he gets a lot of slack, but you know, he's not the greatest player in the league. You know, he never should have won MOP or anything like that, but he is a good receiver. I thought over the years he's improved as a receiver, and you know, he had that one-handed catch on Labor Day a couple years ago that was pretty impressive too. So, you know, it wasn't an SJ Green against the Riders a couple years ago. I think it was 2010, but it was up there as one of the best catches I've seen in a while.
You're taking the Green catch over the Owens catch as best catch you've ever seen?
Yeah.
Where do you put Tony Champion's 1989 Grey Cup touchdown catch? Because to me, that is maybe one of my first memories of football, especially Canadian football. So that holds a special place in my heart. He also did it in the Grey Cup. He did it with a broken rib. He did it for the Ticats. So it's a little bit of bias, but that to me is, if not the greatest catch, I might give it to SJ Green. That catch against the Rough Riders 5 or so years ago was incredible. Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen a catch in any league that was that good, but I can't not pump the tires of Tony Champion's catch against the Rough Riders in the 89 Grey Cup. And it's one of those catches that doesn't get talked about as much as it should, I don't think.
No, you know, it was a catch late in the game. I believe it was to tie the game with, you know, a couple minutes left in the fourth. And like you said, with broken ribs, you know, he landed right on his back. You know, that must have hurt like hell. It was just a beautiful catch. You're right, it doesn't get talked about as much. You know, I think they did a top 10 this week of the greatest catches in CFL history, or what they have on film anyways. And it was on there, but I think it should have been a little bit higher considering the circumstances. Clutch catch in the biggest game of the year. So I love that catch as well.
Yeah, the other catch I always think about when I think of all-time great CFL catches is downtown Eddie Brown in the 96 Grey Cup.
Yeah, I was there, so I remember that I saw him, like, drop it out of his hands, and then people stood up, and I was like, I don't know, it was 96, so I was 11 at the time, and I didn't see him kick it up to his hands. So when people started cheering it, I was like, well, he caught that? Like, what the hell? I thought he dropped the ball. So yeah, that's a really fond memory for me. I'll remember that catch forever as well. So that's really high up there.
I know there's been great catches. I'm sure there's a ton that we're not mentioning, even ones that we've seen. But those to me, the Green catch, the Campion catch, the Brown catch, and now this Owens catcher, I think reasonably, if whatever order you want to put them in, although I think we can agree that SJ Green's catch was probably the greatest catch ever. Mm-hmm. I think you can make an argument for any of those catches.
So speaking of the Argos, does Coombs have the potential to be one of the best Canadian receivers in the league?
I think so. Look, yeah. He was the number 3 overall pick in the draft. The Argos, I believe, traded up to get him. They had designs on using him. He started as a running back. He's sort of filling that Andre Dury role, and he's a lot younger than Dury, and I'm a big fan of Dury. So if Coombs can get there, he's made plays. He's a young guy still. I think he could be the next Andre Dury.
He's shown a lot of flashes of brilliance. You know, he's a fast guy. He can make moves. People miss. So, you know, I remember seeing him play. They have a competition of, like, junior players. I think it's the International Bowl. I remember him seeing him play for Canada against the U.S. And I was really impressed. He was a running back at the time. And I was really impressed how he ran against, you know, really good competition. And I thought, hey, this guy's going to be in the CFL one day making plays. And a couple years later, he's here. And, you know, he hasn't reached his full potential because he hasn't been, you know, I don't think he plays every down. So, you know, I think he has the potential to be one of the best. So it'd be nice to see him play for someone other than the Argos. But, you know, I'm a pretty big Coombs fan, and I think he'll have a lot of success in the years to come.
Imagine what their receiving core will look like when Dury comes back healthy next year. Those two guys, they can run the ball, they can catch the ball, they can return if they have to. I think that could be some interesting weapons for Scott Milanovic to play with next year.
There's a lot of talent in there. Receiving corps, you know, they got the three guys that they brought in this year, Elliott, Gurley, and Hazleton, and then they still got Owens, and then, like you said, Dury and Coombs. So
don't forget Deontay Spencer.
Yeah, Deontay Spencer, like, he's another dangerous guy that with a lot of speed too. So, you know, there's a lot of talent, and they have a lot to work with over there in Toronto.
Yeah, as much as it pains me to say this, if they can find a way to get that defense playing well, you know, the first thing they should do is fire their defensive coordinator in the offseason to get someone in there who actually knows what they're doing. The Argos could be a dangerous team next year. They're not going to have this scheduling nonsense that they've had to deal with this year. And even in dealing with that, they're still 9-5 and are a tiebreaker out of being in first place. Right now, they're hosting the East Semi. This Argos team might be a team to look out for next year. And I remember at the beginning of the season, you and I were very down on them, thinking there's no way they'd compete. And they're going to make the playoffs. So I don't know. If they can get all these guys healthy back next year and find a defense that can, at worst, be statistically average, we might be in a really, really terrible spot as Ticat fans watching the Argos make some noise in 2016.
Yeah, I could see it as well. You know, they so much adversity this year, and they keep, you know, they're sticking around. They're right there with the Ticats. So you never know. They could maybe claim first in the East this year. You know, I hope that doesn't happen.
You shut your mouth.
Yeah, I don't think it'll happen. I think Hamilton's going to snag that spot. But, you know, they just won't go away. So, you know, Trevor Harris has his, you know, he seems to come on strong when they really need him. So, yeah, they could be a threat in the future for the years to come. So I guess, you know, you have to give a lot of credit to Barker for bringing in the guys, and then a lot of credit to Milanovic for keeping them together, even though they haven't had a home game in like 7 years.
Yeah, fair enough. So the Esks finally get a win in Calgary, and now they are in first place in the West, and they essentially have a fairly easy schedule going down the stretch. It's highly likely that the West final is not in Calgary, but in Edmonton. I really don't know what to say. I did not think Edmonton would win this game, but they did do something kind of curious, and although it didn't stop them from winning, I found it really odd that at the end of the first half, they opted against kicking. I'm not sure what the yardage would have been, but it wasn't a chip shot, but it wasn't a bomb or anything. They opted not to kick a field goal, and to me, I just don't understand what they were thinking.
I didn't get it either at all. I mean, I think it was in the 40, you know, maybe 40, 45 range or something like that, field goal. But I was like, why? Like, the clock just ran out. Like, why throw that Hail Mary? You know, the way more likely chance of getting the field goal, you know, put 3 points on the board. Get as many points as you can against Calgary. You know, they had the opportunity. They didn't take it. It was like, I don't know if they just managed the clock poorly, or they were actually, you know, they actually thought, you know, let's go for the touchdown, put 7 points on the board. But like, that's just so unlikely to happen with how far they were away from the end zone. So I was scratching my head. I was like, why the hell did they do that? So I just thought it was a really dumb call by Chris Jones. Like, what the hell was he thinking?
In a game that ended up being so tight, if they would have lost that game by 2 points, Calgary would have found a way to sort of storm down there and score a touchdown with no time left or with very little time left. That would be looked at as one of the all-time bonehead play calls in a long time. But they won the game, so people aren't really getting on them about it. I still think you cannot make coaching mistakes like that, because at some point you're going to make one and it's going to hurt your team.
Yeah, it reminded me kind of last year, the Chris Jones did a fake field goal or a fake punt, like right at the back of his end zones and didn't make it, and it cost the team. So it's just, you know, Chris Jones is a really good coach, but he makes some questionable decisions at times. So, you know, he's got to be careful that when the playoffs come around, because those odd decisions can really come and bite him on the ass if he's not careful. Now, is Riley back on track, or is it just one good game?
Tough to say.
It's tough to say.
Because there's so much evidence that he is a good quarterback, and then there's so much recent evidence that he just wasn't what he used to be. That game against Hamilton sticks out in my mind, where he had like 7 completions and less than 50 yards passing, and they still won the game. We won't get into it. We talked about it before, but that's just incredibly poor performance. That's worse than maybe any quarterback performance I've ever seen. And being a Hamilton Ticats fan, I've seen a lot of bad quarterbacking performances. He's earned the benefit of the doubt because he's done it before, but he's coming back from an injury, so I'm still taking a wait and see approach.
I gotta agree. I mean, he's just been really bad lately, so it's so hard to say. I can't jump on his bandwagon after one good game. So we're gonna have to see down the stretch here if he can really produce. You know, they didn't score a bunch of points, but I thought he played well against Calgary. And if he can, you know, put a couple of games together, then I might jump on his bandwagon again, but not at this point. He just played so poorly in the last couple of games that I can't get behind him yet. But I do believe that he has, you know, we've seen him play great games, so I do have the belief that he can get back there. So I'm not jumping on it yet, but we'll see.
Well, let's see how he performs. I mentioned Edmonton's less than difficult schedule going down the stretch here. They host BC, then they go to Saskatchewan, and then they host Winnipeg before they have a bye in the last week of the season. Those are BC's defense is not good. Saskatchewan's defense is not good. Montreal's is, but by week 19, the Owls might be eliminated from the playoffs altogether, and who knows what they'll be doing. Those games, if Riley can sort of put together a string of decent games there, I'll be more convinced that he is back to what he was pre-injury. Let's move on to the Lions and the Bombers. Winnipeg made this massive comeback, and I'll be honest with you, I was watching the game, and I dozed off. I believe the Lions were up by a touchdown, and Winnipeg had just punted, and it was a late game, didn't start until 10 o'clock here, and it was tough staying up for it, so I did doze off, and I woke up as Winnipeg was kicking the game-winning field goal, and I was in a fog going, what the hell happened? So the next day, I woke up and ended up watching the parts of the game that I missed, and Winnipeg scored a rather controversial touchdown to tie the game. Clarence Denmark got it into the end zone, but there was a lot of hubbub over a potential, what should have been, even by some players or some fans of the Blue Bombers, saying that Troy Studemeier should have been called for offensive pass interference. What are your thoughts?
I don't remember that play. I watched the game. I don't know why I'm drawing a blank on it. I don't remember seeing Studemeier in any controversial call. And I don't know why. I just don't. But I didn't see the highlights or anything. But did you watch the replay of it?
I saw the play, and it's really hard to tell whether it should have been called or not. He did sort of pick, I believe it was Ryan Phillips, but on the angle they showed on TSN, it did kind of look like he was just running his route and Phillips got in the way and they collided. I don't know if that warrants a flag. It did get Denmark wide open for a touchdown to tie the game. It's not as cut and dry as maybe some people are saying it is, and it definitely didn't look cut and dry to me. I'm okay with them keeping the flags in if it's not a particularly egregious error and a most definite penalty. So I'm like, this is a wishy-washy answer. It kind of was and kind of wasn't offensive pass interference, and if I can't tell, then if I was a ref in that game, I wouldn't have thrown the flag either.
Okay, I can see that. I just can't believe that Winnipeg won that game. I mean, first half, BC's offense was just extraordinary. I mean, I was thinking that they looked like the best offense in the league in that first half. It was just incredible. And then, you know, leading into my question, you know, what happened to the offense in Jennings in the second half?
Good damn question, man. I think someone on the panel, it might have been Chris Schultz, at halftime said that BC looked like the most dangerous team in the league now. Because here were Jonathan Jennings' numbers in the first half. 3 touchdown passes, 16 of 18 for 307 yards. That's good for a game, let alone a half. But then in the second half, like you said, he just kind of completely fell off the map. I don't know if Winnipeg made some adjustments. They're not a team. One of the criticisms I've seen of them over the season is that they don't make halftime adjustments very well. But it sure looks like they figured something out and made the necessary changes to put Jennings kind of in a tough spot and make him make mistakes. And this is what happens when you start rookie quarterbacks. We saw it here in Hamilton against in a relief effort against Edmonton and against Calgary. Rookie quarterbacks are prone to making mistakes and prone to having up and down games. And I guess this is what happened with Jennings. Winnipeg found some sort of flaw, some sort of weakness, and exploited it.
I thought the exact same thing that Schulte did. You know, like BC could be a team that comes out of nowhere and just, you know, makes a lot of noise. But, you know, I still think Jennings is a good quarterback. You know, he's, like you said, he's a rookie. He's going to make mistakes. But in that first half, I was like, wow, like really, really impressed. And then he just had so much confidence throwing the ball. Every play, I was expecting him to complete the pass and just move the ball. And then second half came and it just kind of fell apart. So we're going to see him play against a really good defense this weekend in Edmonton. So I'll be at the game. I'm pumped to see how he responds and see how, you know, Riley responds to a good game. And it's going to be an interesting matchup.
Jennings' initial relief appearance was against Edmonton, and he didn't play too poorly. Everyone was knocking, especially after that amazing first half, everyone was telling people to calm down on the Jennings hype train. Like, he's playing Winnipeg's defense, and he played well against Saskatchewan's. And people seem to forget that he came in and played very well against Edmonton. They lost the game, but if I'm not mistaken, BC had a big lead early, and the Eskimos made that huge comeback. That's not on the quarterback. That's on the defense for not being able to sustain a lead. So Jennings has played well against a good defense. It'll be interesting to see how Edmonton plays him after now having played him already. So I think that could end up being maybe the sleeper good game of the week.
Now, I just wanted to touch on something about Winnipeg. Dominic Picard's their center, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you notice his, like, floppy huts? Like, his snaps? Like, they take, like, 45 minutes to get to the quarterback. Have you noticed this?
I have, and it's funny you bring it up because it was something I'd also noticed last year when he was with Saskatchewan.
Yeah, me too.
When the Riders came to Hamilton to play the Ticats, and Tino Cinceri was the quarterback, and it looked like he had to reach forward to grab all the shotgun snaps, and it looked really strange. Like, he gets no velocity on it. It is something I've noticed before, and it's something that, after seeing it then, I've sort of kept paying attention to it. So, yeah, you're not alone in sort of noticing that he's kind of sloppy, would be the best way to put it, on his shotgun snaps.
Yeah, I don't know what that's about. Like, it's weird. It's like he's shooting a basketball with an arc or something. It's very odd. I don't know. It kind of bugs me. I don't know why. It just, like, maybe it doesn't make a difference. But, you know, if the snap takes 7 hours to get to the quarterback, you know, there might be more sacks on the play and it might take away from the play.
Well, it slows the development of the play a little bit. Even by just a half second. That's a half second the receivers are downfield. It's a half second that the quarterback hasn't had a chance to look at the defense. Winnipeg, I believe, once again this year, despite all the changes they've made to the offensive line, have allowed the most sacks in the CFL this season again. So maybe this is part of the reason why.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he's a great center, but it's just, if I was one of the coaches, I'd be like, man, like, put a little bit of, you know, oomph into that, into your huts. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
The week ended with an Argos victory over the Alouettes. Should it have, though? Because I personally think on that last play of the game, the Owls got hosed. I don't know if you're going to agree with me on this, but it sure as heck looked to me watching on television that when Sutton went out of bounds after the inexplicable lateral by Nick Lewis, there was still at least 1 second left on the clock.
It looked that way to me, too. You know, I don't know if the TV clock and the actual game clock are lined up perfectly, but if they are, he was down or out of bounds with 1 second left, and they should have one more play to go, and it would have made the game a lot more interesting, you know, the last play of the game going to the end zone. So, you know, I guess they looked at it. They said they looked at it, you know, to make sure that there was no time on the clock, but to me, it totally looked like there was at least a second left.
Yeah, same here. It's weird. The Owls were at home, and sometimes there can be some shenanigans with the timekeeper and the home clock and stuff like that. You would think playing at home, they would have gotten sort of the call in that situation. Like, yeah, there's a half second left. Because I believe in Montreal, they also kind of run like a hockey style clock where it goes down to like the decimal points. So I can't believe that there was actually no, like, zero time left on the clock. Even if there was 0.01 seconds left, that's still they still get a chance to snap the ball and play. It just looked to me like they got hosed.
Yeah, it's too bad. You know, I was pulling for them to, you know, get that touchdown and go for the 2 points, bring it to overtime, because that would have helped us out with the Argos. So I just didn't understand why Nick Lewis, you know, I do understand. I guess he was trying to make a play, but he should have been aware of the clock. It should have just went down. He had the first, it was a third down. He made the catch. He went out of first down. If he just would have fell on the ground, there would have been like 3 seconds left. So questionable call on his part. But yeah, I agree. They should have had another play. So no matter what.
Yeah, and you're right. There was a couple of errors by the Owls in that last play. The lateral was one. Terrell Sutton made this weird sort of stutter step as soon as he got the ball. He should have just ran right out of bounds. There might have been 2 or 3 seconds left. He just would have taken off for the sideline or just gone down. Like they had, like you said, they had the first down. That's all they needed. Even if the clock runs down to zero after they snap the ball or as they're about to snap the ball, they still get the playoff. That's one of the great clock rules that I love in the CFL, where the clock hitting zero doesn't end the game. If you start the play with time left on the clock, you get to complete the play. I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
They would have had a shot at the end zone. So it's not entirely on the refs for, I believe, botching this clock call. And I eagerly await the CFL coming out and saying, yeah, we got this one wrong. But again, that'll be of little solace to the Owls. But Montreal did a couple of things on that play themselves that shot them in the foot. And so they're not completely innocent in this. It was kind of a mess all the way around.
Now, you know, I've noticed this for a long time at, first of all, Molson Stadium. The seagulls, like, usually they come, you know, at the end of the game, and they're not, you can see them, and there's some there, but it wasn't as crazy as it was the other night. But what is with the, like, is there just a high population of seagulls in Montreal? Like, you don't see it around the league at any other stadium. It's just kind of weird to see all these seagulls flying around in front of the camera, like, almost at every game there. So, what's up with that?
I don't know. Maybe we need to farm this out to an Owls listener out there who goes to these games or lives in Montreal or knows of what the seagull population is like in Montreal. Maybe there is a very dense seagull population, but it does seem weird. My initial thought is that maybe due to all the people leaving, there's leftover food and stuff like that, and the seagulls are trying to feast on that. But people leave games early in every stadium, and this only seems to happen in Montreal. I know I've seen seagulls at other games, but nothing like we saw yesterday against Toronto.
Yeah, it was crazy. Just a funny thing to see. It's like they're playing in the middle of a dump or something. I don't know. It's weird.
Well, let's get off the seagulls and into some football. Speaking of playing in a dump, that's where the Ticats are headed. Maybe they're going to have to deal with some seagulls in this upcoming game as they go to Montreal to take on the Owls in what is a very pivotal game for Hamilton. They can clinch a playoff spot with a victory over Montreal. Montreal's in a bit of trouble because Rakeem Cato suffered a concussion. Anthony Boone, I believe it's Anthony Boone. I could be getting his name wrong. I know it's Boone. I'm not sure what his first name is. He looked absolutely terrible. Tanner Marsh, who somehow quarterbacked this Owls team to a victory over the Ticats in August. He's just looked terrible. He's just he's Brian Brohm bad at this point. Bloody turnover machine.
Worse.
You're saying he's worse than Brian Brohm?
I'm saying he's worse than Brian Brohm.
Wow. I wonder. Maybe we'll have to see what some Winnipeg Blue Bombers fans think of that, because the one thing that they'll point to is at least Tanner Marsh in his career has thrown a touchdown pass. So I don't know who's going to start a quarterback for the Owls, and that makes this hard to predict. Could it finally be Brandon Bridge time?
Well, I mean, why not? Like, you just went through the list. Boone looked like garbage. Marsh is
garbage.
Sub-garbage.
He's sub-garbage.
Yeah, so, I mean, Bridge was the number three guy, you know, or number three, behind Marsh at the time, and he got the start in one game, and then they went with Cato the next game, so I don't know why he's been pushed down the depth chart so much, but he has to get a shot. You know, I guess maybe they can stick with Marsh, but that I think that would be a mistake. You know, he'll be in tough if he plays against his Hamilton defense, but, you know, why not go with Bridge? You know, why not give him a shot?
If not now, when, right? It's either now or never, I think. I'm not sure if he's earned the shot. Again, he hasn't really performed. I believe he's been on the one-game injured list for a while. But Montreal has just been cycling through quarterbacks this season, and no one has taken the reins. Cato's looked the best, but he's had his ups and downs, and if he's hurt, obviously he can't play. This gives me a little bit of confidence going into this game, but I don't want to get too high on it, because as much as it's kind of meaningless, Hamilton hasn't won there since 2002, and the Owls have had Hamilton's number this year. That defense is still really good, and with the addition of Hinox Enoch Mwamba, who was fantastic against Toronto on Monday. He had an interception, he had a sack, he was all over the place. Just an all-around great game, showing he hasn't lost a step. This Montreal defense is going to cause problems for Hamilton's offense, especially with a rookie quarterback at the helm. This was a team that Zach Caleros had trouble playing against. Matthews is going to have equal trouble, but the one big difference is Hamilton's defense is also really good, and Montreal's offense is putrid. So to me, it comes down to, can Hamilton's offense do enough against Montreal's defense? Because I don't see the Owls offense doing much against Hamilton's defense.
No, it'd be interesting to see how the Ticats offensive line bounces back from a really poor showing against the Alouettes last time they played. They gave up 6 sacks, I believe. So they had a really tough time against that Montreal defense. If they can not allow sacks, not allow pressure on Matthews, they'll be fine. So if they can do a good job on the O-line, I think give Matthews time, I think we should cruise in this game because, like you said, the Montreal offense is just really bad right now, and I don't think they're going to produce anything against this Ticat defense.
I still get worried because history is something that I look at. I went to school for it, and it's always something that's in the back of my mind. So knowing the history of Hamilton's deficiencies in Montreal in the regular season still gives me pause. And we've seen games when these two teams played back in Hamilton in just before Labor Day. I'm pretty sure we sat here saying the Ticats should walk away with that one, too. We probably said it'll be a close game because Montreal was looking decently at the time. They'd just come off a win, but they had fired their coach. Since then, they've looked really bad. So I'm cautiously optimistic, I guess, that the Ticats can get this win. They can clinch first place. Or not first place, sorry. They can clinch a playoff spot. And then we can start looking forward to the big key back-to-back showdowns with Ottawa to end the season. But in this game, I think I'm with you. I think the Ticats should easily beat Montreal as long as the offense can do just a little bit and not turn the ball over. If Matthews doesn't turn the ball over, Hamilton will win this game.
Just boggles my mind that the Alouettes with Tanner Marsh behind center beat the Ticats earlier in the season. It's just crazy to me. But yeah, if we can, like you said, if we can just play decent on offense, you know, maybe get some special team stuff, maybe another block punt, maybe a speedy B return, I think we'll be fine against the Alouettes. Even though it's been a tough place to play, you know, they're due for a win. They haven't beat the Alouettes yet this year. The Alouettes are on the decline right now, so Hamilton's going to go in there and snag a win, I believe.
Yeah, the Owls are ripe for the picking, so if they can't do it now, I'm not going to, you know, the season's not over if they lose to Montreal, but it will be a severe blow to their hopes of hosting the East Final.
Yeah, and it's just nice to get to, just to know that this team's going to be above 500 for sure, you know, get to that 10-win mark. 9-9 was okay for, you know, 3 years in a row. You know, we were coming off some really poor seasons, but now I want to see winning seasons like every year. So getting to that 10-win mark is always a good thing.
So what is your bold prediction for this game, my friend?
Okay, I'm going just the whole defense. You know, if Tanner Marsh is playing, it's pretty much a guarantee. 3 interceptions, 2 pick sixes.
Wow! I'm also going with the defense, but I'm going a little bit differently. I'm saying that they are going to hold Montreal to under 250 yards of total offense.
Okay, that's a good one too.
So we both think the defense is going to cause super problems for Montreal. And if both of our predictions come even close to being right, even if we're wrong, if the defense gets a couple interceptions and even one touchdown and they hold the Owls to like 310 yards of offense, the Ticats have won this game. The questions this week are minor in number because both Mike and I had a bit of a brain fart. And I guess we could blame it on the Thanksgiving meal. I just completely forgot to ask. And I guess you did too. So yeah. We only got one this week. And it comes from Randy Rhino, of all people. I doubt that this is the actual guy, but no. I said last week that I wanted to get this name on the podcast every week, and now we're 2 for 2. So if Randy Rhino wants to keep asking questions, please do. I still think this is the greatest name in the history of the world. It's making me smile just reading it right now. So thank you to whomever the commenter was that decided their name should be Randy Rhino. I very much appreciate it.
Keep firing them off every week so we can get that name on the podcast.
Anyway, his question is a really good one. It is, who do you see being the starting QBs for all 9 teams in week 1 of the 2016 season? Do you want to go team by team and we'll go back and forth?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, so let's start with Hamilton. I think we're both going to agree. If he's healthy, it's Zach Caleros.
Yeah, for sure.
Who do you got in Toronto?
I got Trevor Harris.
I also have Trevor Harris. Who do you have in Ottawa?
I'm going to go with Burris.
I'm also going with Burris. What about Montreal?
Ricky Ray.
Oh, me too!
No way.
Yeah, I think that's exactly where he's going. We talked about it last week when we were talking about what, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago. I can't remember we talked about this before, where Ray's going to go. I think that is exactly where he's headed. And I think, maybe my bold offseason prediction, I think he gets traded to Montreal before the end of the year and then signs a contract extension with the Als. But I think Ricky Ray is an Alouette next year as well.
See, wouldn't that be interesting, eh? Ricky Ray and Alouette. You know, he could have a couple more years in him. So, you know, and then Calvillo being the offensive coordinator, maybe could work a little bit better with him because he's kind of similar quarterback to what Calvillo was. So, yeah, that's it's a weird thought seeing Ray in an Alouette jersey. But yeah, I guess we're on the same page that it could happen.
If Montreal is able to keep all those veteran players there for one more season and they acquire Ricky Ray, I think they automatically shoot up into Grey Cup contenders. They're a quarterback away right now from being a contender. So you add a healthy Ricky Ray, that team is a threat.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be interesting? You know, you have Ray in Montreal, Trevor Harris in Toronto, Claros in Hamilton, and then Burris in Ottawa. That's some pretty good quarterbacking in the East.
That will make for a very interesting East division. So let's move on to the West. Who do you got in Calgary?
Mitchell.
Yeah, same here. Edmonton?
Riley.
Yeah, same here. Saskatchewan?
I think they'll be. I think they'll go back to Durant.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Winnipeg.
Yeah, they'll be with Willie.
BC. I'm with you on Willie. So yeah, let's go to BC. Who do you got there?
I'm gonna go Jennings.
Same here. We got the exact same. I think there's gonna be a legit quarterback competition in training camp next year, and I think Jonathan Jennings will beat out Travis Lule.
I agree with you as well. You know, Lule's been the guy for a couple of years now, and I think he's going to take a backup role because he's just been injured too much, and he's not the same quarterback. So he'll be a really good insurance policy for sure if Jennings is the starter.
Yeah, the problem is he's just not reliable anymore. Travis Lule is a redhead. I'm a redhead. We got to stick together. We're bros. He just doesn't have it anymore. That magical 2011 season. Well, you know, when next season starts, it's going to have been 5 years. And he's looked good in spurts, but he just can't stay healthy. And Jennings has looked so good in relief of Lule so far. And Lule's healthy now. He was in uniform against, who'd they play this week? Winnipeg. He was in uniform against Winnipeg. So
yeah.
They went with Jennings. Maybe he's not 100% back, but they went with Jennings. And I think they're going to go with Jennings again this week. I think he's the guy going forward for BC, and that's the CFL team that finds quarterbacks like no one's business. So Lule as the backup, maybe he's the guy next year that we have to listen to all this stupid talk of, will they trade a backup quarterback somewhere? Maybe he's the guy next year instead of Kevin Glenn. You know what I mean? Like if a Burris or someone goes down, or maybe Drew Willie goes down, and be, oh, well, will the BC Lions trade Travis Lule to Winnipeg? Blah, 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 blah. Maybe that's the chatter. We're getting it out of the way now because that's probably going to be the chatter if Lule's the backup that we're going to hear next season.
You know, you don't hear much chatter about Drew Tate as an option for a trade, you know? Like, he's been a good quarterback when he's been in there, but you don't hear, you know, when a quarterback goes down, you know, trade for Drew Tate.
That's a good point. Maybe teams, or maybe commentators, are just not dumb enough to think that the Stamps would trade him. I don't know. Maybe the Stamps, maybe it's because, I think all the Glenn talk, and God damn it, we're talking about Glenn again. Maybe I think all that stems from the fact that Saskatchewan's really bad. If Saskatchewan was in the hunt for a playoff spot, you're not hearing this chatter about Glenn being traded anywhere. But we're hearing it because the Riders are now officially eliminated from the playoffs. Hamilton's win over them knocked the Riders out of playoff contention. So that's probably why we're hearing it. But in any event, God damn it, we didn't even get through the show without breaking our moratorium. Although we didn't say where he was getting traded, so I guess we're still technically okay.
Yeah, we're still good.
All right, but that's okay. Enough of Ray. Not of Ray. Now I'm ripping on Ricky Ray for no reason. That was a Freudian slip. I like Ricky Ray, but anyway, enough of Glenn, and I guess enough of this show because that was the only question we got this week. So as always, don't forget that you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and if you have a question for either Mike or I, and we are both not dumb enough to forget to ask if you want to put a question in, you can hit us up on Twitter. Mike, give me your Twitter handle, pal.
Mike_TyCats.
And I'm @JoshSmith_82. And be like Randy Rhino. Come up with an awesome name. Put a comment in the comment section of 3 Down Nation with a question, and we will get it on the show as well. So, for Podski Weewee this week, I am Josh Smith.
And I'm Mike Graham. Eat 'em raw.
Eat 'em raw.